Packet Pushers.
Hello and welcome to the Network Automation Nerds podcast, where we explore the latest in network automation from a practitioner's perspective. I'm your host, Eric Cho, a network engineer who loves everything about network automation. Today on the show, we're honored to welcome a very distinguished guest with us, Michael Kennedy, founder of TalkPython Training and the acclaimed host of the TalkPython to Me podcast. As a pioneer in Python education, Michael has empowered countless Python developers worldwide to unleash the full potential of Python in their projects, from web development to data science, and of course, DevOps and network engineering. This episode is also very special to me because Michael is a personal friend who gave me countless valuable advice in my career and podcasts over the years, including writing a very special foreword for the third edition of my book. The only question I had when I was prepping for this episode was, what took me so long to invite Michael on? Well, here he is, Michael Kennedy. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me on the show. It's great to catch up with you.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, I kind of know why I waited so long, because I was waiting for the podcast to grow up a little bit. Otherwise, you would just be doing me a favor, right? Like, I really wanted to have a wider audience, introduce, you know, TalkPython, both to training as well as the podcast to the audience, because I think those are just awesome resources.
Well, thank you so much. As you, it's something I've been working on for a long time, and it's growing up and coming up on 10 years for TalkPython, and just a little bit shorter from my other podcasts. And so that's a while.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think it's 9 years now, right? And so next year will be 10 years, which we're approaching the end of the year. So it's pretty close. And I still remember the early days where, you know, I found your show and then I was able to just scroll a few pages to listen to most of the episodes that were interesting to me. And, you know, I reached out to you immediately because I wanted to know who's this person on the other side of the mic that was talking. And you were nice enough to just respond. And long story short, you start giving me a lot of advice and valuable ones, including on and off the camera.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly had some fun chats at the various conferences and stuff.
I would actually point people to your podcast, and it's a weekly podcast, right? So there's a lot of episodes coming up, almost 1,000, right? 940 or so. Is that correct?
No, it's half that, unfortunately.
Oh, really?
Only half.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah. But it is a weekly show and it's a couple hundred.
Yeah, I think it's 400. And I literally put down Adobe Audition to talk to you because I was working on releasing that. And it's 480 is the one coming out today.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah.
And the topics are so far-reaching and covers a lot of different topics, including DevOps, data science. And the recent episode on education was really rewarding to me because, you know, we both have kids and my kids are coming up to the age where, you know, I was wondering why they wasn't able to grasp some of the concepts on the earlier age. And then now it made more sense to me on, you know, kind of their brain development and so on. So I think whatever you're interested in, you just go to the show, you scroll like the 10, 11, 12 pages, whatever it is, like how big your screen is, right? And then you'll find something that's valuable to you.
Yeah. Well, you know what I've been working on a lot lately, actually, is search.
Oh, really?
Like improving search for the podcast. So you can go and type in the search and see what you find.
Do you integrate AI or anything like that in your search?
You know what I wanted? I honestly, when the whole LLM craze hit, one of the things I wanted to do was create something like an Ask TalkPython.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sort of section, right? Where,
right.
Where it's some sort of LLM, but it's trained on the 480 hours of transcripts
right.
and stuff, right? And then you can ask questions like, well, what do the experts feel about this? Or when Eric was on the show, what did he say about, you know?
Oh, that would be amazing.
Well, but I didn't do it because one, it's hard.
Yeah.
I got more important things to work on. But two, I'm just afraid people would abuse it. Like, well, here's a free ChatGPT to ask just random questions that has nothing to do with why I built it. So someday, maybe. Not yet.
Yeah, I think they're making it easier and easier. I mean, I don't know if OpenAI was what you had in mind, but it's now easier than ever to just upload like either transcripts or I think audio files as well. And then they just kind of, you know, have this rec in front of it where, you know, you could talk to it directly. So I could say, hey, you know, what would Michael Kennedy say about this particular topic? And it would just go through that first.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. They do have pretty big limits. I tried to just give it the transcripts and it will barely take one episode and it'll run over its context. And I wanted to give it, you know, 500. It wasn't having it. So you got to do a little bit more to make that work. And that's when I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'm not doing this. Maybe it's interesting for your listeners. One of the things I've been doing recently is doing a lot more local LLMs that rather than ChatGPT type stuff. I don't know. I just kind of like the privacy. It doesn't matter that much, but also it just kind of makes me feel good to just go like, it's just here. This is just mine.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a thing called LM Studio at lmstudio.ai, which gives you a ChatGPT interface, but then it's got basically most of the Hugging Face models. So you say, just type in Llama or Mistral or Phi or whatever it is you're looking for, and it'll just give you like, here's the biggest model that will fit in memory on your computer that you could possibly run. And so then you can have a bunch of chats and stuff there. So that's been pretty cool.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. So you don't have to like go build a Docker container that has LLM, and then you have to have that web in front end and all that stuff. And then you just have one model, right? Then you have to do that for X amount of models that's out there.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, I think I jumped again a little bit. I got so excited just talking to you, but let's back up a little bit, zoom out and say, Michael, for people who are not familiar with you or your show, your trainee, who are you and how did you get here?
Well, hey, everyone, I'm Michael. I've been a software developer for a long, long time. I went to school for math. And I thought math was going to be super awesome. But then the farther I got along, I realized, you know, pure math, the job opportunities were a little sketchy. So they were a little few and far between, and they're a little weird. Like, oh, you can get a postdoc for 1 year for $25,000. Then you reapply and you move again. Like, you know what? What else could I be doing with my math skills? And so I got into programming, originally doing C++, and then I did a bunch of C# stuff for a while as well. And it was a lot of fun. And then I started teaching and doing conference presentations and just really, really enjoyed that. And kind of as part of that vibe, I started the Talk Python to Me podcast. I was looking to sort of change technologies a little bit and switched over to Python. I thought, well, where are all the stories? Where are all the people talking about, you know, whatever's going on, or what are the new framework? Where are the trends? And there was literally zero podcasts. And I'm like, well, I'm wholly unqualified to start this, but no one else is doing it. So let's just see how it goes. And if I invite some smart people, maybe I can make it work. And it worked out really well. People loved it and been basically doing the podcast and a bunch of online courses. I've been doing that for my job for 8-9 years now.
Yeah, which is amazing. I think you're the first person who kind of turned a, I don't know if we want to call it a side hustle, but you know, because you fully intended for it to grow bigger, but you were the first person that I know personally that I was able to grow something into and replace their full-time job. But you had to hustle initially, right? Like you mentioned.
Oh yeah.
The podcast was for 9 years, now almost coming on 10, but you've been doing it for 8. So for that first year, you were just kind of juggling different balls in the air.
Yeah. For the first year, I was doing the podcast where I could fit it in.
Yeah.
And I was also really specific to not be doing it as part of my job because it was my thing. I wasn't getting paid to do it, but you know how companies are, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
And so I'd get up at like 6:30 in the morning. Hey, can we do it? Or stay up really late or some weird time or something and making it go. And then after about a year, I decided, you know what? I'd never thought I would have sponsors, but companies came along and said, hey, your show's cool. Can we pay you money to talk about this thing or whatever, you know? And pretty soon I had to start saying, no, all the ad spots are sold. I don't know what to tell you. Yeah, I'm like, wait a minute. If I could spend more than 4 hours a week on this, I bet I could do something awesome. And so, yeah, then I just quit my job, launched the first course on Kickstarter.
The Kickstarter. And, yeah, that's what I was going to spin it out. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a blast from the past, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you don't really hear about it that much now, but when you were doing it, you were actually one of the first to do it that I remember to do it through a course, because most of them were like products, right? So you would deliver the products, you know, afterwards or people get a t-shirt or whatever.
Let's get an umbrella that it's a smart umbrella. If it rains, it has a fan that goes up. Some random thing, right?
Yeah, like host my beer too. Yeah, you were very successful in doing that. And that was actually one of the first things that I asked you was, you know, how did you achieve your goal so fast and, you know, being featured on the front page, if I remember correctly, right? Like you were actually featured on the front page because it was so successful and so on. And you gave me some great tips on, you know, just how Kickstarter worked and the kind of research that you did behind the scene. It looked easy, but only because you put out so much work up front.
Yeah, it does. It looks easy when it works. And I'm sure there's a lot of survivor bias things going on. However, basically, I could not work on the courses while I was working at the company I was working at because it was also a developer education company, right? Yeah, exactly. Right. And so it would be a conflict of interest, but I could imagine what I was going to do just in the shower. Like, what could I do to get some awareness, right? And so I had just thought a whole lot about how can I have a lot of little milestones instead of some big milestone and things like that. And I think that's actually anybody who has a product, that's a really good way to think about a product or service. You can, hey, it's done and here it is. Take it. Or here's part of it. Here's another part. And every week or so, being able to talk about, oh, here's something new and another legitimate reason to just be reminding people how cool it is and now how it's a little bit cooler. And I kind of did that with Kickstarter, right? I had small goals and then I had a bunch of graduated goals all along the way. And it was so exciting. It was really fun.
Yeah. Again, I think you're the pioneer in a lot of these things that were like, you know, build in public, learn in public and incremental, you know, developments. Back then, I mean, now it's kind of common, but back then it was kind of unusual, right? Like people usually buy a finished product, and especially for a Kickstarter, it's like you said, it's an umbrella that does all these cool stuff, you know, but you don't see the build process. You kind of get that finished product and you wonder why this thing that falls off right away. Because that's usually what happened. Right? I would say 50% of the product on Kickstarter did not meet expectation or like what they promised to do.
There were documentaries about how Kickstarter is going to democratize. And I mean, it had its moment.
Oh my God. How do we spend like 10 minutes on Kickstarter and haven't even get to the meaty part? I don't know, but because I'm just so excited to talk to you and catch up and all that. But yeah, you know, back to your origin story. I know you were, very deep into math. You got into programming and then you started to, you know, have this podcast, which is uber popular, and you start your training business. So how's that going nowadays? I have to admit, you know, I had a gap where I haven't listened on a weekly basis, but, you know, I went back and, you know, you had a new intro, you had this professional voice actress, I think, or just, you know, kind of read out your name by the awesome Michael Kennedy. And so how's that going, by the way?
Yeah, the podcast is going great. You know, it's fun to talk to all these people and it's a really cool platform to just say, you know, as you know, like I'm really interested in this thing. I want to talk to the person behind it. I bet if I did that with the microphone, would be interested, right? And so just, if you love constant learning, if you love discovering new things and meeting new people, like that's a really cool thing to do. And so, yeah, it's going really strong and loving it. The courses are good as well, but like I think the way people are learning is starting to change a little bit in interesting ways. And I think LLMs are part of it. I think TikTok is part of it. Mm. I've got multiple messages from people. Why is this introduction to this 6-hour course? Why is it 15 minutes long? Could it be 3 minutes? You know, they're just in like the mode of like a swipe. So it's just a really interesting world. So that's different, I would say. But yeah, it's still going good.
I think that's the part I was going to bring up is the evolution of your training, the evolution of the podcast, because, you know, I remember in the beginning, you didn't have video, you didn't have semi-live recording, right? Like it's kind of live stream on YouTube. And now you get the benefit of the live audience. So you will leave some time at the end and just kind of answer to people. And there's nothing could replace that kind of live feeling. So I think, you know, same thing as training, where you just mentioned on people like swipe up, swipe left, or whatever direction they swipe to.
I don't know which direction you swipe.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know, Python dating app or whatever, right? Like swipe up. But yeah, you know, like the evolution of it, and you're adapting to the constant changes of people's attention spans now 30 seconds on TikTok or whatever, then maybe you're like, I don't know, integrate Python with the latest dance move or something.
Unfortunately, I'm not good at dancing. Although maybe that's exactly what would make it successful if people watching me try. I think honestly, technology is just getting better and better and better, and it's getting easier to do stuff that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And so that, I think that's neat.
The same thing with the podcast. When you first started, you have to go, I don't think you have to source your hardware, right? VM existed, but you do have to, you know, kind of encode your audios and do the editings, you know, upload manually, maybe figure out the XML feeds and so on and so forth. And nowadays there's like StreamYards, and which you introduced me to, and also, you know, a bunch of other platforms that just handle end-to-end. You pay them $20 and now you have a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. And not only do you have a podcast, it's live streaming to 4 different locations at the same time. And like there's all sorts of wild, wild stuff. But and most of these things run in the browser, which like blows my mind. Just like, okay, here's an entire production studio in front-end JavaScript. glad I don't have to write it, but it's cool.
Even I think Adobe is actually moving to the browser as well. I mean, you used to be Adobe, you know, video editing, audio software are so heavy-headed that you can't fit into the browser. But nowadays, I mean, I just got an ad from Adobe and say, hey, you could do it in the cloud now. So, you know, you just have to like, I don't know, give it some prompt. And now you have like a flying horse in the desert, something like that, with like a beautiful music in the background.
Yeah.
I do want to get back into software development at some point.
Let's do it.
Talk to us a little bit about software development process and why is Python a superpower, right? Because I think that's what you labeled it at times.
Sure. So I know your audience are network professionals, not necessarily, hey, let me fire up, you know, some high-end editor and start writing Rust or C++ or contribute to the Linux kernel or whatever.
Maybe right? Some, like 1%.
Yeah, of course, obviously. But generally not. And
right.
I want to stress that I don't suggest that people just drop what they're doing and become a software developer. Like,
right.
You know, there was a lot of that, I believe, you know, around the same time as the Kickstarter thing, actually. Like a lot of politicians and stuff tonight, oh, we need more coding jobs. We need more coders. We got to have like learn to code and hour of code and all these people learning code and kids need to code. And like having literacy and programming is valuable. But
right.
I think the framing that we should put out there for the listeners is instead of saying you have this thing you really experienced at and you love networks and network automation and put that aside, drop that and go learn programming. No. Instead, think of all the things that are tedious or slow or manual. Mm-hmm. How can you learn enough programming so that it becomes a single statement on a CLI rather than a bunch of stuff that you do? And in that context, you probably don't want really, quote, high-end languages like Rust that are there to support very structured programs like kernels and stuff, right? You want something that is dynamic and exploratory and easy to get started with. And, you know, Python really, really fits that bill. And the other thing that's special about it, the reason I think it's a good recommendation for a lot of people is it's what I call a full spectrum language. So You can get started really easy in a lot of languages. Like there's even visual programming languages, but other simple ones you can get started with and you can go so far, like think Bash, for example, right? You can do a lot with Bash, but at some point you've outgrown it and you need like a real programming language, right? Like Instagram is not written in Bash.
Yeah. Good luck creating that in, you know, your block coding. Yeah.
Yeah. But then on the other side, you know, I was talking about the Linux kernel, right? The Linux kernel requires way more advanced languages for that kind of stuff. And so you've got to kind of learn a real language that is disconnected from the easy getting started. It's harder and it's slower to accomplish things from a programmer perspective, but it has this really high-end capability. And Python is very unique in that it you can be very effective with it with a super partial understanding of what it is and what it does and how to work with it, right? You could say, I don't even know, like, let's say what a function is. I couldn't make one of them, but I could still put 6 lines of interesting stuff into a text file and get a cool picture, a real-time graph of like what my network looks like or the traffic over time or something like, or analyze a log or, you know, whatever, right? And it doesn't make you understand the whole thing to be useful with it. Mm-hmm. You can understand surprisingly little about it and get stuff done.
I'm pointing to myself here.
But I mean that in a positive way. But as you grow, you don't outgrow it really quickly and have to switch to something else. You can just start to involve more of these ideas and more advanced libraries and more advanced concepts. And so in that sense, I think it's kind of a full spectrum language. And so a lot of people who come into it, especially from the data science side, don't come in as programmers, but they stay in the ecosystem because they don't outgrow it, right? And I think that that's something quite special about Python.
I agree. I think, like you said, I mean, 2 things that I got out of that conversation. One is that, you know, you don't need to be a coder to be useful. You want to be a doctor who codes or a nurse who understand coding logics. But you don't need to code for life or code for food. You just need to, you know the logics. And then you overlay that with network engineering. Yes, you know, you could still be a CLI jockey when you're doing network architect. But hey, you don't, like, for the 1,000th time of doing config T or interface IP change, let's automate that. Then you could focus more on your architect and the more interesting stuff. And then the second thing was the reaching the ceiling, in which I have personally haven't reached that ceiling, maybe just because I'm not very good. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I do spend a lot of time coding in Python and trying to do different stuff. In your recent episode on education, you know, you talk about hardware, right? Like those are the things that in the beginning of my journey, I would never think that was possible, right? Make lights lit up or my earring runs Python. How about yours? It's like, yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely true. I really do enjoy those 2 points.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll bring this back to hardware and networking for you. So I know there's not video, but I'll got my little.
Oh, wow. What is that?
This is a CircuitPython. I think it's an ESP32. Just to give people a sense, this is a thing that is, if it's in the palm of your hand and it's probably, I don't know, 2 centimeters across by 3 centimeters long.
It looks like a USB thumb drive. Yeah.
It does. Yeah. That's about the size of it. And it's a $25 completely programmable chip that you can program in Python. And what it does is it joins my Wi-Fi and it doesn't run the equivalent of a Pi-hole, but it manages the DNS from my network and then like works in concert with nextdns.io. And it'll make sure that like my IP address is the one that's configured with the right settings, even if my IP address changes. And because
wow, that's mad.
Anyway, isn't that fun?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, did you get that from like Adafruit or some other hardware vendors?
Yeah, I bought an Adafruit and then just put CircuitPython on it and played with it for a day or two, and now it just lives on a little to the wall, you know.
Yeah, and that doesn't take a lot of power either, right? Like that's like, you know, like I don't know, 5 watts a year or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to have a huge computer on to manage stuff. It's not even a Raspberry Pi. It's like, it's more like a watch.
Yeah, Raspberry Pi in comparison, it's like a giant. It's like, hey, you could write like software defined networking controller around it, and then like this one is just what you need to do and off you go.
It's really wild. So it's things like that, right? Like, I mean, that's kind of a toy example, but these small little things like, okay, well, I could go back and make sure if my IP address changes, I resync some settings somewhere, or I could just never do that again in my entire life. You know, I could write one thing to just make that happen.
Yeah.
Or I've written a bunch of Python code to sort of report on and control a Docker cluster for our APIs and our infrastructure and stuff. And
yeah,
sure, I could SSH in there and do some stuff, but, or I could just type one line in the CLI and get a nice refreshing visual representation of what I wanted to know, you know?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Docker, and I know a lot of our audience are, you know, kind of network engineers. So we're kind of isolated from the rest of the world, but the rest of the world has been, I would say, migrated to containers and at least partially in, you know, Kubernetes for that matter. So I know you have some thoughts about Docker and, you know, kind of DevOps. So tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah. Well, for a long time, I'm like, okay, this is complexity that I don't need to worry about. I'm not running a huge cloud company. I don't mind if my website has 10 seconds of downtime per month. That's okay.
Right. You could reboot that VM.
Yeah, I can reboot it once a month and, you know, get the security patches applied and whatever, and it's fine. Right. And so it's not something that I needed, right? It's not like I had to have it because without it, there were problems, right? It's not that critical. But there's plenty of traffic. There's millions of requests. There is a decent amount of infrastructure there, actually, which I think way more than most people imagine for a lot of these things. Anyway, started working with it a couple years ago and just couldn't be happier. I think there's a lot of interesting things that would apply for network engineers. Right. One, the Docker networking is super interesting. And I think knowing how it works will be just valuable on its own, right? Because surely you're going to be working in some situation where somebody's doing something with Docker and they're like, well, is it a host bridge network? What kind of network is it? Is it an external, you know, like,
I thought you were the network expert.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't even know what this is. Like, no, man, what is this? Yeah. I think honestly, just knowing that would be good.
Yeah.
A lot of listeners will be familiar with like configuring servers in terms of like Linux commands and stuff. And really Docker is just a file full of a bunch of Linux commands, right? It might have a Docker key. Your Docker file is basically, these are the automation steps that I take to set up this container. But really what that means is like an Ubuntu server or something along those lines. And then you can also piece them together in interesting ways. So you could prototype, well, what if I set up the networking this way and have these things, you know?
Right.
I think there's a lot of spin up infrastructure and play with it really quickly.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, there's just a bunch of tools out there that here's what this setup looks like. Do X, Y, Z, set it up on your machine. Hope it doesn't screw up your machine by installing it, or run a Docker command. It's not going to harm your computer no matter what, basically.
Yeah.
And yeah, it gives you the ability to just try stuff out, try new tools, try to connect this thing, try this monitoring thing, try self-hosting some things. So for example, at TalkPython, we have our own self-hosted web analytics, and it's far better than Google Analytics, like far better.
A better privacy.
Well, yeah. And here's the most important way. One, it's completely private because it runs on our infrastructure. We've got like 17 apps that run in our Docker cluster. One of them is that thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. One of them is that thing. And so we keep the data. You don't go to the website and give the data to somebody else.
Right.
It's open source and free. The thing that we're running is called Umami. But here's the magic. It runs on a subdomain of our domain. And so it's not blocked by any blockers. Pi-holes, uBlock origin, Vivaldi max tracking settings, whatever it is you want to give it. It doesn't care because it's like, well, that's part of the website. It needs it, you know? Because when we were doing Google Analytics, we'd get maybe half of the traffic. Yeah, well, exactly. We get like maybe half of the traffic. And I think the results we get from that were not representative of the general user because there's the people who had blockers on, there's people who don't. They don't behave the same, I don't think, in general, right? There are different type of users. So taking the reports from one and thinking about the other, but then you need those stupid cookie banners. Like, what a bad idea those cookie banners are. I mean, I support some of the ideas of the GDPR, but the cookie banner is not solving anything, you know what I mean? But since we don't have third-party cookies, so why would we have cookie banners? We don't need to say we have HTML. I mean, the cookie banner is saying we're shipping your data off to other places.
Right.
So,
right. And then you have to like opt in. Yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff. But we're not shipping anyone's data off. So I think people who come visit appreciate that. I know I would when I visit other sites. So anyway, this is kind of a long-winded story to say all of that stuff gets like ridiculously easy if it can be packaged as Docker and just run as a Docker container with Docker Compose or something. Whereas if you've got to, well, set this up and, oh, you're going to need PHP and, oh, have you set up Next.js over? Like, whoa, 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 whoa. This is out of control, right? But if all you do is run a Docker command, then all of a sudden life gets super easy and there's a lot of options. And so for many, many reasons, I think people should pay attention to Docker.
Yeah, and I think it has reached a critical point where whatever you want to do, somebody probably have made a Docker file for it, somebody made a Docker container for it. You could even just, you know, download it from Docker Hub or, you know, somewhere else. I mean, I was in the same camp as you. I mean, I was, you know, talking to one of my friends whose company was about to go IPO, and he was just saying, and this was like 2018-ish or something, and he was just like, oh, you know what, like we're migrating everything to Kubernetes and Docker. And I was just like, why, right? Like, you're a network engineer, why are you adding more complexity to it? This is yet another thing that you want to worry about. Your pager will go off when it doesn't work, yada yada yada. And you know, I still held that belief even after 2018 for a little bit, and then I started discovering, and you know, kind of, you know, somebody twisted my arm and said, no, we got to do Docker because this is how it's going to be. And then I discovered it, and I you know, kind of find it interesting and start being useful to it. And now in the networking world, you know, we have Container Labs, which is, you know, kind of, you know, used to be network labs are very heavy handed. You can fire up more than X amount and with like, you know, gigs and gigs of CPU per unit. But now with Docker Container Lab, that they're very lightweighted. And that's the whole thing with a container, right? They're lightweighted, purpose built, and ephemeral, that you just, when you're tear it down, it's just gone. So yeah, I nowadays 100% agree. And then there's a whole ecosystem to it, like Kubernetes, now that it's marrying Docker with Kubernetes and Container Lab. And so that's a whole other thing that probably we don't have time for that.
No, I'll give a quick final thought. We don't actually run any Kubernetes for ours. We just use Docker Compose.
Docker Compose,
because there's a whole nother level of networking complexity and stuff with Kubernetes. And for me and my simple set of apps, it's just, it doesn't require it. So I'm still somewhere in the middle of that. I'm trying to like keep things simple still. But having a bunch of small servers, which is what I had before to manage, you know, $5 server here, $10 server here, let them, like, that's also a hassle. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So stop doing
agree
that.
Yeah. on Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're being humble about, you know, your small operation, but it's still, like you said, millions of requests and 17 different apps that, you know, maybe they're not all core, but do require to, you know, have all different functions and so on.
Yeah, we do about 10 terabytes of traffic a month.
Yeah, that's a lot, right? Like, you know, even if you count, like, okay, so it's videos or streaming, so it's a lot, but that's still, you know, a good decent chunk. So that even with then, you don't need Kubernetes. You could just do Docker Compose and get a bug, you know, string up together a bunch of containers. So that's cool. Let's get back to Python a little bit. And, you know, async await, that's one of the, I don't want to say new, but relatively new, I guess, because a lot of network engineers, you know, when they first get started, like you said, you know, they're not coders. So we're happy to just get to work. Like, hello world. Yes. Success.
Yeah.
And then now I get to do something. Yeah. Yeah. I'm done. You know, like, let's go get some lunch. But, but after that, you know, you start chaining up the operations and then it becomes blocking and all that. So tell us a little bit, when was async await? And it took a little bit, right? Like to kind of, you know, organically grow to the state today. So tell us a little bit about what it is in, you know, why do you need it?
Yeah, sure. So async await, there are two keywords that allow you to do primarily network-based asynchronous or parallel programming, right? Which is
right
down the middle of what y'all are interested in. So with Python, they just had yesterday, they just released a new version that has kind of true multi-threading, true parallelism to take advantage of all the CPU cores and stuff. But this was released 8 versions of Python ago. So something like 8 years, a little bit longer than 8 years. It's not always the year. Originally it was every 18 months. So something like that. It's been around for a little while. And so the idea is, if you have functions that you're calling that you're waiting on something, you just put the word await in it. And then Python says, oh, I see, we're waiting on things. So you can go do other code, like other network code. So for example, if you're doing Paramico calls, I don't actually know if it supports async or not, but if you're doing, let's say, some sort of network API call, right? You can use a library like HTTPX.
Yep.
And then that will let you asynchronously talk to those. Mm-hmm. So you say, I want to make a call to that API to maybe check on that switch or that server or something. And if you await it, then you can say, and now while you're waiting for that that server to get back to you over the network, let's talk to this one. And now that one's also, we're waiting on that one. So let's talk to this. And you can just completely scale up the speed at which you can talk to things on the network, because it basically takes no work for the program to just say, oh, I'm waiting on a network response. So until that comes back, let me just go do something else. It takes a very, very slight change in the way you would program, but it's very slight compared to the benefits you get. So I think it's super worth thinking about. Like, I'll share a story that one of the listeners sent in to me, because I was talking about this and said, look, you need to be able to do this. If you're talking about stuff on the internet or talking to services, they were calling a bunch of different services all over the internet, or maybe even web scraping. I can't remember, but they said, I have this program and it used to take, I don't know, let's say 4 hours to run. And I switched to this async programming model. Now I have a new problem. It downloaded so much data that it ran out of RAM and crashed because it was going so fast.
You're just moving the bottleneck from I/O to, you know, memory.
Once I slowed it down a little bit and got that sorted, it took like 5 minutes or something, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the type of stuff that you guys are doing, where you're talking to kind of a vastly distributed system, I'm talking to that switch, to that thing over there. And it's so primed and ready to just completely amplify it with, while I'm waiting for that thing to get back to me, let me talk to the other 1,000, get them all started, then we'll come back and see what that one said. You know, like, that kind of coordination is super easy with async and await. And it's certainly, I don't think people should worry about highly advanced programming, you know, software engineer concepts. Like, you haven't done the PR request right, where the automated bot has run the test. So we're not going to, like, no, forget all that, at least in the beginning. But this is one of the few, what I would put in the advanced category of things, not that advanced, but it's advanced, that is so valuable to what you guys are doing that it's worth, like, stretching a bit to learn that.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think waiting for API calls on a Cisco switch, that is, you know, network engineering equivalent of watching the grass grow.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're just twiddling your thumb. And yeah, and I think the good thing is also for network drivers, like you said, right? Like some of them support it, some of them don't. But Scraply, actually, with Carl Montessori, I may have messed up his last name a little bit, but yeah, so he actually wrote a driver for it. So if you're, you know, in the Nornier space and, you know, you could actually just get that driver and it would take care of it for you. And the best thing about it, as Michael mentioned, is that it's all kind of underneath it, right? Like it's abstracted from you. You just have to conform to what the syntax are and you conform to a few rules. Then you get the vast benefit of, you know, synchronously go talk to these devices at the same time. And then depending on how fast they respond, you could, you know, vastly reduce that time. So what is that Netflix show on chess? This young lady who was playing like 10 boards at the same time. Like,
yeah,
that's kind of that analogy,
it's kind of like
right?
That. Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. Exactly.
Yeah. Instead of like going to the first person and then you wait for like the other person to come back, she's like, oh, I have spare capacity to play 9 other players. So she goes around and just play them.
That's true for computers. I don't know if that's true for me, but computers have a lot of cores, and certainly from a networking perspective, they're kind of crazy. So
yeah, I think that's a great point on finding out the feature that benefits you the most and spend time on that, right? Like you don't have to worry about CPU bound, you know, tasks if you don't need to. And but you know, we're definitely IO bound on, you know, network stuff. So yeah, I think that's back to what you're talking about on just picking out the stuff like network engineer learning to code. You don't have to be a coder, but you know, just picking out that piece that's most valuable to you, spend time on it, get the most benefit, and just move on with your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And you also talked about development environment, right? So for some of us, you know, just getting started on Python, we use the original editor and that, you know, catches some of these syntax errors or, you know, just like having more colorful editor. But there are actually better IDEs out there and some of this that you're familiar with. So tell us, what are the IDEs that would vastly improve your efficiency on development?
I'll certainly tell you. Let me get to the answer kind of indirectly, right?
Sure, sure, of course.
Here's one of my litmus tests for a good library, a good editor, etc. If I'm trying to do something, how often do I have to go look at the documentation or the help to understand what is available? What am I supposed to be doing, right? So for example, if I import Paramigo and I type Paramigo dot, it had better give me a list of the things that Paramigo does. I mean, not just nothing.
I don't know.
Or, yeah, it's like, well, you go look it up. Like, no, I don't go look. Yeah. You can look at the libraries. You can tell me what they do. And please fill it out. When I hover over it, show me the help. Mm. If I make a mistake, tell me what I did wrong. And the two right. that I think are absolutely head and shoulders above the others are PyCharm and VS Code.
Mm-hmm.
PyCharm, there's a pro version that has a paid component, but for network automation stuff, like the things that are missing from the free version, which is data science and web HTML writing, is not generally that big of a deal. Or VS Code, which has got a ridiculous number of extensions you can put in and does all sorts of stuff. So both of those, but if you're using VS Code, I think it's really almost impossible these days to miss this step, but make sure you install the Python extension for VS Code. Because without it, you kind of go back to that thing I complained about, you know?
But like you put the dog in silent.
Exactly. Or it'll autocomplete, but it only just drops down the other words that happen to be in that file. You know, you're like, this doesn't belong here. What is this business? You know what I mean?
Got it.
Yeah. So I think that's pretty important, and it will really make a big difference for people. If you're using the REPL, you know, what you get if you just type the word Python,
right,
the read eval print loop, or idle, which is the one that comes with it, or basic VI or nano or whatever you're using. So many of those fall really, really short of being able to basically guide you. And now a lot of them, when you bring in the AI LLM stuff, it's ridiculous. Like,
yeah,
PyCharm ships with local LLMs for every language. So it has a Python LLM. It has a CSS LLM, it has a HTML. And as you type, it just says, you know what? I've looked at your code and your libraries. If you hit tab, I'll basically complete the whole thing that you expected instead of just completing it.
I didn't know that. Okay.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. And it'll say like, okay, I see these are the variable types they seem to have the name as the parameters. And so it'll like write whole lines of code. And then with VS Code, you've got GitHub Copilot, which I think, I don't know, for me, it might go too far, right? It writes not just little bits to lead you along, but it's like, hey, how about I just write the rest of the program and you can read what I wrote? I'm like, that might be too much for me. But, you know, some people may find that real valuable, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, I think it was not even really a close call whether those are the two good choices, but then you throw in LLM assistance on top of it, and then it's just like so productive that I think it's very much worth considering.
Well, it's worth pointing out that you have courses on both, right? So either way, you know, you'll go to Talk Python Training if you want to learn more. And obviously you went into the pro version under training because I think it's just like Django projects or Flex or, you know, one of those, right? So you actually fully take advantage of the PyCharm part. I haven't gone through the VS Code part, but I imagine that's the same thing. Do you think they're on feature parity? Because nowadays, and well, first of all, I don't know about the LLM part on PyCharm, so I'm going to go. I've been paying for it for years and haven't taken advantage. So, you know, I should take advantage of that.
So be careful. There's a paid LLM GitHub Copilot ChatGPT type thing that goes in there. Okay. But that's not what I'm talking about. Like,
yeah,
there's also, and just in the latest version, there's just... your autocomplete is way, way smarter because there's a private machine. It doesn't send your data. Like, that's part of the problem with GitHub Copilot is it sends your machines and your API keys and everything off to the internet, right? Whereas the PyCharm one is just a local LLM. I look under the autocomplete settings about that. But yeah, it's kind of confusing because there's two levels of LLMs in PyCharm. And I don't want people to think, oh, I got to pay for this. Like, no, that's not the one I'm talking about.
Right. The autocompletion is... interesting. And for me, when you brought out these extra features or extensions on VS Code, I mean, that's for me, that makes the difference on, you know, kind of the ecosystem that you pick. For me, you know, I've been using VS Code lately for a while now. And because they have all these extra stuff like live share, when, you know, you want to just like do live coding and pair coding, you could approve locally, and then you have that chat function to, you know, highlight your code. And nowadays, because of, I don't know if they're one happy big family, but they are one family, like Microsoft with GitHub and like CoSpace and all of that. So it almost like they're locking me into that ecosystem by all these like beautiful gardens. And I walk in and I'm like, hey, it's pretty comfortable here. I think I'll just stay.
I'm just going to sit in the sun here. Like, why is that wall there? I don't know what that wall's for. I don't care.
Exactly. So far away from me, I'm okay with that. Yeah. So we talked a little bit about, I guess, AI. We have to talk about a little bit, like LLM.
Before we move on, can I tell you one more suggestion for this editor thing? Although this is not an editor. Are you familiar with Warp, the Warp terminal? Is in warp.dev?
No, go ahead.
So here's the thing that's interesting. So people are used to using the built-in terminal, hopefully some better. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Windows terminal if you're on Windows rather than the CMD.
Yeah, like iTerm. Yeah.
Yeah, or iTerm 2, all those different things. And I know it's got to be some of the people out there listening have like the most amazing customized terminals and shells out there. They just have to, right?
Spent hours and hours on that, you know, little extension. And
there's this new one called Warp, which is... at warp.dev, not associated with them, just a fan. But
sure,
it's got like a really nice autocomplete for all the stuff, all really nice history. The reason I think about bringing this up is it has this capability to project your shell customizations forward into other servers. So if I SSH to a server, you'll see it like doing a thing where it puts like your customizations and stuff into the remote machine's shell behavior. So you get the right shell kind of history and other autocomplete. So you also do things like type hash and then, or command I, depending on how you set it up. And it'll have like an LLM. You just say like, how do I just count the distinct types of file extensions or something like that? And you could just type that as text and it'll go, here's the command, you want me to run it? And you go, yes. But that works even into Docker, right? So if I say Docker exec dash IT, something blah, 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 right? Like that's how you kind of shell into a Docker. Then you can just hit control I or command I and it'll like basically instantiate the smart shell inside of Docker instead of just the basic one. So on the outside, we have all the editor stuff. And then on the sort of DevOpsy side, something like this warp.dev is super cool because a lot of what people used to say is I'm going to use the most minimalist common denominator type of setup so that when I'm in my server or my other remote thing, I don't feel out of place when I drop into a crummy editor or a crummy shell, right?
QVI here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so this is kind of the reverse. Like, what if I could project my nice shell into the other things rather than the other way around? So I think maybe just rounding out that conversation, something like this. I've heard ghosty, but I don't know anything about this one. But there's a couple of these types of newer terminals that are cool.
I could totally see that because, I mean, back to VS Code again. I mean, one of the things that I like about VS Code, and the first thing I would install is the Docker extension, right? Mm-hmm. So that, you know, when I fire up Dockers, and then I could just like right click to it and go attach to it. And again, that's the lowest denominator where, you know, you're back to it. But if I spend any more than, I don't know, a couple of minutes on it, I would go ahead and install Vim. And then I need to do like the Vim configuration on like highlighting for like line numbers and whatever, you know, things. I have a pre-built thing where I copy and paste, right? But now that you're talking about Warp, whereas I get that nice feature rich remotely and it's all happening automatically without, you know, me doing too much work on it.
Yeah. I guess one more thought on this, since you're talking about VS Code, one of the things I really like about VS Code is the ability to have VS Code SSH into a server.
That's right. Remote development. Yeah.
To do the remote development and have basically the core of Visual Studio Code running on the server, but the front end, because it's electronic, it just basically would be a web presentation back to you, right? So I'll do that all the time. I'll connect to the server over Visual Studio Code. And then you'll see like on the file explorer, like that's whatever part of the server I told it I want to work with. And the editor, it's really nice as well. I think that's a super cool feature.
I don't know if it's for a long time, but at least initially, VS Code had a better remote development experience, in my opinion, than PyCharm.
Yeah. I think it still does. And I've tried it in PyCharm and it was...
Yeah.
I wanted to make it work because I love working in that thing, but it was just like, it was hanging up and there was all sorts of, you know, like the app would hang and then, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not built for that scenario. So when it comes to that, yeah, that's the one I use.
Nowadays, I guess kind of tie everything together. I do all of my development remotely now just because the Mac ARM processor doesn't run a lot of the Docker stuff. So I want to make it uniform on, you know, the production stuff. So I would say almost 90% of the stuff I do are remote development and including like, you know, live share, including the,
nice.
The Docker attached exact and all of that. So for me, it's everything combined and, you know, like it makes it really seamless. And like you said, you know, that wall is pretty far away from me and
it's
I'm
fine.
Happy for now. Yeah. I mean,
they brought cookies. It's fine. let me add one more tool in for you. Are you familiar with OrbStack? ORB Stack?
No.
OrbStack is an alternate of Docker Desktop.
Okay.
What's cool about OrbStack is it will, even on Apple Silicon, the latest Mac OS, it'll run Intel-based Docker containers through Rosetta.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So if you've got something that needs to run on Intel, you just get the right Docker container and it'll just automatically, when you say Docker start, just go, okay, we're going to use Rosetta for that and run it over emulation.
Was there any performance hit at all? Or because that's another abstraction layer, right?
Yeah. Well, I think there's the whole Rosetta overhead. When they came out with Apple Silicon, like, I did some tests and even in emulation mode or whatever you call it, the Rosetta, the x86 emulation ran faster on my Mac Mini than it did on my MacBook Pro, which was Intel.
Oh, okay. I see.
So there may be some overhead. It might've been faster still without it, but the Apple Silicon was sufficiently faster than the previous year's Intel that it was still faster than the Intel version. You know, it's like, so there's some trade-off, but it's not a huge trade-off.
Yeah, like you said, it's what you're comparing to, right? Like if you compare it to like the pure with or without Rosetta, it's, you know, it's faster. But if you compare it to like, was it 3 years, 4 years ago?
Yes.
Like the last generation of Intel.
It'll still be faster. It'll be quite a bit faster, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's an interesting option.
Yeah, totally, totally. I mean, I didn't know that. So we'll provide links in the show notes for people to check it out. And I might just go download it right after this call.
Yeah, try it out. So, I mean, there may still be plenty of reasons for the whole remote setup, like, because that's only a very small slice of it, right? But it's an interesting thing that solves.
Yeah, when I'm like 30,000 feet in the sky, I'll thank Michael for, you know, introduce me to this.
Exactly. Hey, I can work on this when I'm not connected. That's right.
Hey, Mr. Boss, I am working. And he's like, hey, how do you work without? Well, hey, you know, there's a thing. Have you heard about Warp or?
Yeah, yeah.
Warp to stack.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I mean, we touch a little bit on LLM and of course, you know, like, I guess by extension, AI. So what is, you know, kind of your interaction with it? I think you mentioned a little bit on, you know, whether there's the IDE portion or whether that's, you know, your own running locally. So what are your thoughts on that, on just the whole LLM regarding to software development? Are we all like losing jobs or anything like that? Like, you know,
it's going to be interesting, right? I think those of us who already have a lot of experience, you, me, a lot of the listeners,
mm-hmm.
it'll be fine, right? We can take these tools, we can use them to amplify us. What it's unclear to me what's going to happen is, how do you get to where you and I are? You do it for mm-hmm. years, right? You start with simple problems, you get bigger and bigger problems.
Right.
And you start as a junior of some variant, and then you work your way up. Well, the LLMs are really good at doing some of that junior type of work.
Right. They're like 70% there.
My concern is not for me, it's not for you, but I think a little bit of the concern is, how do we keep the pipeline of people coming into the industry real healthy? If it's like a little gap to go from junior to intermediate to senior sort of levels, and we hack a big chunk of that out with LLMs, like, how do people cross that boundary anymore, you know?
Right, right.
So there's two possibilities. Maybe the LLMs help them go faster and they spring across it and they're just higher efficiency and effectiveness, or
that's an ideal situation.
This is optimist Michael. The pessimist Michael is like, it's just much harder to get into the industry, which I hope it's not. Right.
Yeah. There's just gonna be this gap, the pessimist Mike would say.
That's right. It's gonna be there. But the LLMs mess up code all the time. They're not just there to replace you, but they're super helpful in some certain circumstances. Like, I just don't know how to do this. Maybe if I at least saw an example, if it's not perfect.
Yeah.
Right. Kind of like, I read a Stack Overflow post and it's not exactly my situation, but I learned what I needed to learn to adapt it. I kind of see that's the way with LLMs. Like, I can't remember what I was parsing time zone specific times and I needed to translate them to some other time zone. I'm like, I don't remember how to do this. Let me ask the LLM. And it said, these are the 7 steps. Mm-hmm. And I go and put them into the editor and it's like, that library doesn't exist. I'm like, what? Or this part of that library is not a thing.
Yeah.
So I ask a different model and gave me the right answer. I'm like, huh, okay.
Oh, ask a different model. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the quality of the model versus like just LLM in general, I guess, in a particular example.
In this particular example, it just made up of, oh, there must be on the daytime module, there's this thing about time zone. Like, no, there's not. There's not.
And luckily, you know the maintainer. So you call up, you know, Scott or whoever and go, wait a minute.
Hey, Paul, we need to talk about time zones. Yeah. Man. Come on now.
Which is actually a very interesting episode on Talk Python, right? Because, you know, it's more complicated than people thought. It was like, how hard is it to convert like Eastern time zone to Western? Of course. Yeah. Sure.
Easy.
Yeah, easy. No. Yeah, try to convert like several of them at the same time and taking in daylight savings time and, you know, the differences in, because some regions implement daylight savings time, then they got rid of it and then they re-implemented it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I lived in Indiana for a little while and I believe different counties in Indiana either did or didn't respect daylight savings.
Oh, no kidding.
So the one that I lived in, half of the year I was in central time and half of the year I was in eastern time. Right. But I think maybe other counties over weren't. It was really weird. I mean, it was a county by county thing, and this is not a problem I want to solve, right?
No. And luckily, you know, somebody else solved it, but we're all benefited from the person or the group of people who solved it. And it's easy for us to just, you know, calculate the number of days, just, you know, 2 lines of command, but a lot of work went into it. And, you know, back to your Talk Python to Me podcast, right? That's why it's so useful. I never thought about how difficult it is and all the, you know, things that went into it until I came into that episode and go, yeah, you know what? If I get paid to do this, you know, how would I do it? Whoa.
Every layer you peel back, it's like, oh my goodness. Yeah.
That's a great way to put it. It's almost like every single thing is an onion and you just kind of peel. Like, and I like the analogy because it does make me cry at times.
It does.
So we've both been to PyCon and you're now a PSF, Python Software Foundation Fellow. Like, tell us what that is and, you know, kind of, you know, by extension, what PyCon is, PSF, maybe just give a, you know, high level overview. For network engineers who just got into Python, they don't know what PSF, and they may have installed something from PyPI, which benefited from it, but they don't know what it is. So give us an overview.
Sure. Well, let me tell you a bit of a story here.
Sure. Go ahead.
I won't make it too long. So one of the things that's really weird about Python, and probably weird in a good way, but not 100% in a good way, is that there's no organization that controls it.
Yeah. Like Microsoft with C#. Yeah.
Exactly. You want to know about C#?
Yeah.
You ask Microsoft.
That's right.
You want to know what's being added to C#? You let Microsoft tell you. You want to know what web framework you should use? You wait for them to tell you which one you should use. Right? And the same thing with Apple, right? And iOS, and I guess not picking on Microsoft.
Swift, whatever.
Yep, yeah, exactly. With Python, it's like kind of 1,000 flowers blooming. And
right.
So there's the Python Software Foundation, the PSF. Mm-hmm. That's why I told that story. They are in charge of kind of overseeing the health, almost from a legal perspective, but also somebody wants to sponsor some aspect of Python. Like I think Google made some big sponsorship to hire somebody for the security. I can't remember exactly what, something along those lines, if that's not exactly right. And that would go through the PSF to hire that person to work on Python. But in general, they don't really control it directly, but they kind of oversee the well-being of it.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, thanks. And then, so the PSF fellows are just people who were nominated by the community as like a reward for making a contribution. So that I ended up getting that, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what I was nominated for.
Since 2018, Michael's still confused.
Exactly. But then I get a notice, hey, you are a PSF fellow. I'm like, that's awesome. What's that?
Yeah.
Sounds cool.
Thank
you. Basically, it just means like the community said every quarter they pick five people and they say, we want to kind of put their name on a plaque and say, thank you for doing something for the community.
Right.
So they did for me for all the podcasts and the awareness and the community building and stuff.
Yeah. I want to also signal that it's kind of a feather on the hat. True. But they also put the year that you were, you know, introduced, right? So your name was 2018. I checked. Yeah. Hopefully you're not still confused. You're certainly not. But yeah, so it's been 6 years.
Yeah, once I got a message about it, I went and did a little research. Now I understand. They just announced the five new people today, which is interesting. Although I didn't go and look, so I can't congratulate them or anything. But
I mean, who gets to vote? I know that your peer fellows, you know, get to vote, right? And then the community gets to vote. Is that true or still the case?
There's another group of people that's much larger called the PSF members. And basically, it's kind of like you just go to the Python Software Foundation. Yeah. You kind of sign up. I think there might be a very, very small support fee, but it's either free or it's a couple bucks or something like that. I can't remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's the voting group.
Got it.
I think.
Got it.
Yeah. So back to PyCon. So PyCon is put on by the PSF.
Yep.
And there's PyCons all over.
Yep.
The two main ones. There's, I believe these are kind of directly put on. Certainly the one in the United States, the what's called PyCon US, is put on by the Python Software Foundation. But then there's other ones like PyCon Philippines, which I believe is put on just by enthusiasts in the Philippines, but is somewhat funded by the PSF. So there's kind of like an official one and there's semi-official ones, but I would just like to encourage people, if it's easy for you or you're interested, to certainly go to this. I've talked to so many people at the conference that have said, I almost didn't go. I didn't think this was for me. I thought I was like some weirdo that worked on something unusual compared. And I came, I belong here. I met so many people here.
Yeah.
I'm so much more connected about this, you know, to the projects, to the people behind it, to the community.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's kind of like my geek holiday. I highly recommend that people go. Almost everyone I've spoken to who was new is like, I wasn't sure this was for me, but this is for me. Right. So it's a good time. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, I was there in 2013. So that was like, I don't know, 3 years into my, you know, Python journey. I certainly didn't think I was qualified to even like step into the location.
They're going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're going to check my Python card and I don't qualify. They're just going to kick me right out, you know, in Santa Clara. I remember that 1 year. But yeah, no, certainly I feel welcome. I feel I belong, even though half of these talk, I don't even know what they're talking about, right? Like even by the topic. Yeah. But I'll tell you just kind of an example of what that atmosphere was like. You know, in the beginning of the keynote, you know, they dedicated time to say, hey, if you're talking in a group of people, you want to have that Pac-Man circle, right? So what that means was, you know, you want to leave room for people to be able to step in. Like, I don't know if people are familiar with the Pac-Man logo or, you know, like that little symbol thing,
It's like a pie with a good slice taken out of it.
Exactly. So you want to leave room for people to step in and expand that circle, but always leave room for people to step in and enjoy the conversation, because it's intimidating when there's like a whole circle of people talking and then you want to join that conversation. Like, what do you do, right? Like, you just stand behind some dude and behave like a weirdo and breathe into the neck, whatever, right?
Hey, there's a guy behind you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, no, exactly. I think you better step aside, do the Pac-Man thing. But yeah, they went ahead and said that. And I think that was actually in practice. I think there was a like feeding room. Like, that was the first conference that I saw for mothers to breastfeed, for breastfeeding room. And like, all of these examples that I saw were the first from PyCon. And that's kind of the atmosphere, like the welcoming theme that they do. Yeah. And I also want to, you know, when you're talking about PSF, I want to bring back that they do so much more things. And I have a lot of guests on my show where they start side projects, but they were not sustainable, right? Because it's just some dudes in the garage trying to maintain it. And what PSF have established a model was, like you said, they were funded by PSF, but they don't directly interfere with it. They just, you know, recognize the contribution and make it sustainable, such as some of these littler conferences around the world, or open source project, such as, I think Flask was one, right? Are you familiar with that story? You probably tell a better story than I do.
I don't remember the story around Flask, but there's plenty of really nice local events you can go to first. There's Pi Tennessee, there's Pi Ohio, there's like lots of Pi Cons.
Every single state.
Pi Cascades, right? Which is kind of bringing home.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Pi Cascades for the win.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So they'll meet you where you are. So I guess that's a good summary. So go attend those smaller ones. And then if you want, you know, go to the PyCon US. And I don't know what the attendees were. I know they were down a little bit because of COVID. And when it's over, people, you know, kind of hard to break that habit of going back to conferences. But hopefully, you know, they're back to their normal attendees, because I know they used to get 50% of the funding from the PyCon US annually.
Yeah, which is crazy. But yeah, that's still true. The attendance is coming back. It's going to be in Pittsburgh this coming year. And trying to remember, like, end of April.
Yeah.
It's April, May. I have the dates, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
Right.
And then after that, it's in Long Beach. It always goes to a different city for 2 years. So Pittsburgh, and that's going to Long Beach for 26, 27.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's another thing. They committed for 2 years and then they go to different cities. It's not always Silicon Valley, right? So it's Utah, it's Pittsburgh. Yeah. And it's not always Vegas. No. Enough conferences in Vegas.
Vegas is crazy.
Okay. So I think, you know, we could go on forever, Michael, but we're coming up on time. I mean, I'll definitely invite you back if you're willing. Let's wrap it up for some awesome Python resources, pun intended. Yeah. So that was the last link that you kind of brought up in the talking points. So tell us what it is.
So with Python, you've got different layers of, like, if somebody says, I'm interested in using Python, or I'm using Python to do this, they might mean I'm using the language,
right?
For loops and strings and whatever.
Right.
They might mean I'm using the libraries that come with Python. This is called the standard library. It often is like sort of sold or marketed as batteries included because it has a lot of capabilities out of the box.
Right. Daytime, for example.
Yeah. Daytime. We talked about that. For example. However, there's something called PyPI, the Python Package Index. Yep. And a lot of languages have package indexes these days. And, you know, it's like apt for Ubuntu and Debian and so on. And there are 500,000 libraries.
Amazing.
99.9% that are free and open source.
Right.
That are literally type pip install the thing. And now you have graphing. Now you have network capabilities. Now you have HTTP capabilities, whatever. The real challenge becomes almost a paradox of choice,
right,
type of thing.
Right.
Where it's like, okay, great. I have all these options. I'm new. I'm not going to go through the 500,000.
You could, but it's not recommended.
It's not the recommended path.
No,
become familiar with
not these. The easy path.
So I want to highlight something on GitHub by a person named Vinta called awesome-python. Mm-hmm. And what this is a curated list of, you tell me what you're interested in. We'll tell you the popular recommended libraries for doing that in Python. So for example, if I'm interested in caching,
yep,
I could use something called Beaker, which is WSGI middleware, or I could use Django Cache Ops or Django Cache Machines, or, you know, Python Disk Cache, you name it. But there's also one for networking. So whatever you're up to, they've got a couple for network virtualization. Mm-hmm. So Mininet, Napalm, Pox. Yeah, very cool one. I had the guys behind Napalm on the podcast.
Yes.
So I think, you know, if you're doing engineering network automation stuff, it's not just the network virtualization, but there's like, how do I call APIs? How do I read this kind of file, this format, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to start from scratch. There's probably a thing on PyPI that'll get it there. So I just want to bring up that list as a way to help people orient themselves as they're getting started.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I didn't know this. So it's actually curated by an actual human being. So no hallucination. It's just probably a vetted list that's very useful for people to get started. So yeah, thank you for those resources. You know, I think that becomes very helpful for people who are either new or, you know, even after a while, they can't possibly know the 5 million languages or gazillion languages, packages or libraries that are out there, right? So a curated list would be very helpful.
Yeah, this is a good resource.
Cool, Michael. So where can people find more of your work? Where to, besides, I guess, Talk Python podcast or the training, where can people follow you on?
Oh, a lot of places, but I would say there's two jumping off points.
Yes.
One is Talk Python, just talkpython.fm or talkpython.com, whichever one you feel like. One will get you to the other.
Yep.
So that's kind of all the podcast stuff and the courses stuff. If you want to follow me a little more in particular, there's mkennedy.codes.
Okay.
Which links to, that's like where I write my essays and it links to all these other things.
I'll subscribe to that.
Yeah, thanks. And I do a bunch of stuff on YouTube. So I've got a personal channel and a podcast channel, like you pointed out earlier, live stream that stuff all the time.
Yep.
So people can subscribe to the YouTube things if they wish.
Yeah, I think if you subscribe to it, whenever you're just about to go live, you'll get like a little notification. And hopefully you're not at work, or if you are, like if your work allows, go join and ask a bunch of questions.
Put on the AirPods and put in a little picture-in-picture window in the corner.
Yeah, we didn't try to do that, but yeah.
No, we didn't say that.
Yeah, but again, Michael, it's always nice to catch up. Thank you for being here. It's been a pleasure. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. Great to catch up as well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Network Automation Nerds. Do you have any feedback for Network Automation, our guest Michael, or this episode? Send us some follow-ups at packetpushers.net/FU. FU stands for follow-up. We want to hear from you. Check out our website at packetpushers.net to find other network engineering focused podcasts, blogs, YouTube videos, and much more. You can find podcasts such as Network Break for weekly shows, Heavy Networking for deep dives, Packet Protector for security, and much more. Last but not least, remember that too much network automation will never be enough.